You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. In recent months, a rattled financial market has some economists predicting recession. The last time the U.S. faced the beginning of a recession was 2007, and it was spurred by the collapse of credit and the burst of a housing bubble. In 2022, economic signs show that history may be repeating itself.
Well, a rising number of financial experts say that the U.S. is headed into a recession as inflation continues to soar.
Intense demand and diminishing supply have sent home prices soaring, and there's collateral damage from the housing shortage, record rent increases.
Housing concerns aren't unique to the United States, though. We are in the midst of a global housing crisis.
As we look at some of these bubbliest housing markets around the world based on the economics work that Bloomberg has done, whether it's New Zealand or Australia.
In 20 years ago, 2002, a home on average cost 4.5 times your income. Today, that multiple has risen to 9 times your income.
It's hard not to notice. The signs are all around us. An estimated 150 million people around the world are homeless, maybe more, and around 1.6 billion people live in inadequate housing conditions. That's according to the United Nations, which now calls homelessness a violation of human dignity. The crisis has been decades in the making, but more recently, the pandemic, climate-related weather events, and the widening gap between rich and poor have only made the problem worse. This week, we look at some solutions to the housing crisis around the world, people working together and sharing knowledge so we can all learn. We start off across the Pacific, where a homegrown construction startup is building thousands of new homes for India's urban poor.
Indian population in urban areas is estimated to go from 30% to 60 to 65% by 2035. We add an area equivalent to the entire area of Chicago to our urban space every single year. We are looking at requiring about 20 million houses by the year 2023-2024.
That's Aditya Jain, CEO and co-founder of Tavasta, an Indian 3D printing company based in Chennai in Tamil Nadu.
Tvasta, or T-V-A-S-T-A, is a Sanskrit word. In Sanskrit, it means to create something out of nothing.
Jain and his co-founders recognize the urgent need for fast, affordable housing in India. And in 2020, Tvasta built India's first 3D printed home. The prototype took 21 days to build, in spite of a few challenges.
So this was when COVID was sweeping throughout the country. And this was also when Chennai was facing a massive hurricane.
Designed in collaboration with an architectural firm, the 480 square foot house has a covered porch and big windows. Its walls are both curved and squared and painted white. There's a traditional foundation, but otherwise, the house is printed.
This is not a small 3D printer that we are talking about. So we are not using plastic. This 3D printer is the size of an entire building.
Think of gantry cranes at ports, massive steel scaffolds that load and unload goods. In this case, the gantry has an arm that moves back and forth, printing in lines with a special kind of concrete.
So this is very similar to sort of how we ice a cake.
These 3D printers can make homes on or off-site. In this case, Tvasta trucked modular pieces from a factory to the building site and connected them together.
It is similar to how we assemble Legos in a lot of ways.
Jain gave us a Zoom tour of the prototype house on the campus of the Indian Institute of Technology, Madras, located in Chennai. It's his alma mater.
This was the first 3D printed house in India, and it's a one bedroom, one kitchen, one hall structure. It's really like a studio apartment. When you enter the house, it has both curved wall elements and square wall elements coming in together to give it a very nice architectural and design feel. And what you enter into is essentially the hall and the kitchen of the house. So you have wooden furniture, white flooring done using tiles, and a curved kitchen wall, which has slabs and a wash basin made available. We are now moving towards the bedroom. So this bedroom has French windows, which give it a very good level of sunlight throughout the day. And at the same time, the sight outside is beautiful. We are looking at a banyan tree. There are two doors which lead into and outside the house. The walls of the house are painted white and yellow, which give the house a very spacious feel. And the flooring of the house is done using glazed tiles.
There's also a small bathroom with a toilet and handheld shower. Part of one wall is left unfinished, so people can see and touch the layers of printed concrete, which look kind of like wafers in a tiramisu you might order for dessert.
People in India feel safe when it's a concrete structure because that is what they aspire to have in their lifetimes. A lot of people in India live in thatched roof houses and structures where walls are not made of good materials.
Jane says they can now print a studio house like this one in less than a week, and they're working to scale up production exponentially. Tavasta's also looking at printing multi-story apartments. The aim is to produce housing that costs about a fifth to a quarter less than conventional construction. They've got to do something, Jane says.
People live in very squalid conditions. The slums of Mumbai and Chennai and other cities are not a pretty sight, and we feel really bad when we see how people are spending their lives in thatched roof houses with leaky walls.
His company's efforts are backed by groups like Habitat for Humanity, which supports startups like Tavasta as a way to help address the housing deficit in India and around the world. Jane is proud the company's technology is homegrown, and he looks forward to printing thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of homes. He knows how much the idea of home means to people, a place where they can feel safe and secure.
To make that difference to a person's life is a very significant achievement for me. And if we are able to do that at scale and at a cost that is workable for people, we as a team will feel that we have made a good dent in the universe ultimately.
The work of Tavasta is making a dent. What can we learn from targeted local solutions like it? And how can we work together to make them more sustainable? Joining me to discuss all this is David Ireland, CEO of World Habitat, a London-based organization sponsoring innovative, people-powered housing initiatives around the world. And Yasmin Lari, she's known as Pakistan's architect to the poorest of the poor, and she's the founder of the Heritage Foundation of Pakistan. David Ireland, one of the most daunting things about this, and I mean, there's daunting things about it all over the place, but just the sheer scale, the number, the portion of humanity that doesn't have a proper place to live is just so huge, it's bewildering. How do you get going on a monumental task like this? Can you work on a number of fronts at the same time?
Yeah, it is overwhelming. I mean, I think the UN estimates somewhere around 1 billion people are homeless or inadequately housed. And I kind of think, I mean, you know, when I was at school, we were taught there was 4 billion people on Earth, and I think it's nearly double that. So it's increasing all the time. So the problem's big, but you have to keep running really hard, even just to stand still, never mind actually house all of the new people that come onto Earth. So it is huge. But I think the thing that I sort of find is that there's lots of communities around the world that have solved this problem, and people have worked out how to house themselves. It's a kind of known thing. We're good at it. What we've got to do is make sure we get back to those skills which sort of taught us and got us housed in the first place.
What is the difference between homelessness and inadequate housing? Because often the terms are used even in the same report, but rarely defined.
you could write a university thesis on that question, Ray, but there is a something about rooflessness. So people who have no roof over their head, people who are living on the street, and people who are rough sleeping, whatever term you might use. But there's many more people who they might actually have a roof over their head on a particular night, but they don't have a security of somewhere where they can permanently call home. So they might be living in a temporary shelter, they might be living in a refugee camp, or they might be living in somebody else's house on the sofa temporarily. And those people suffer in many ways almost as many challenges as those people who are roofless. That's a more obvious sign of the problem.
Urbanity, the flock to cities, is one of the things that's driving this problem. If you look at a list of the largest cities in the world today, it includes a lot of places that are getting big because people are abandoning the countryside, flocking to cities as a means of survival. And it seems to me that that's almost a recipe for inadequate housing.
Yeah, it's a very rational thing to move to a city. And actually, a city done well is a great place to live. Where it doesn't work is where you've got lots of people moving to a city where there's no room for them and where there is no provision for them. And they do the only thing that they can, which is to live informally, to live in spaces which people haven't given them permission to build, the structures with the things that they can afford and the things that are to hand. And they then end up living in a very vulnerable way.
Are there rules of thumb? Running water, a sewerage, an adequate amount of square feet, a place to sleep, to keep your stuff? Are there metrics that we can look at and say, no, that's not a proper place for a family of five to live?
Most countries have got some legal definition or some legal rules around what is adequate and what is not. But I think it's really more about what the impact on that household and what those people are, because it will differ according to the way people live, the climate, the amount of community space there is, the amount of, you know, some people don't need to be in the house that much because there is so much that is available communally with those people. So they would need a different size house from a community where that doesn't exist so much. But I think you just have to look at the community and look at the people and see where it's impacting. You know, those people who are well housed, they've got security, they've got somewhere safe they can go home to, somewhere where they can interact with the other members of their family, somewhere where they can learn, somewhere they can eat, somewhere they can sleep. And if a home does all of those things and keeps some people safe and secure, then it's doing the right job, whatever particular style of that house and how that, whatever the particular rules of that country are.
One of the things World Habitat does, as I understand, is act as a clearinghouse for innovations and ideas, and you solicit designs and suggestions from around the world. Can you give us some examples of things that have come your way that were developed on the cutting edge of housing?
Yeah, we do. We run this competition in partnership with UN Habitat called the World Habitat Awards. And we've got a pretty rigorous system for going through and working out what is the very best of those projects. And we work with them for several years afterwards in order to try and help them develop and help transfer their ideas to places where they need them. And there's been some great examples. I mean, one of them was a system in Finland. Finland is the only country in Europe which has effectively ended homelessness, and it's done that by a long program of what's called housing first, so providing a secure home for homeless people rather than expecting them to sort out their social problems first and making housing conditional on, you know, sorting out your addiction problems or sorting out your mental health problems. It provides the housing first and then provides the care for people once they're in those homes. And it just basically works much better. And so I'm really pleased to see that idea has grown. It's taken off in the United States, and I think we've helped it grow in Europe. And many cities now around Europe are beginning to see the sort of turning the tide on homelessness and the numbers beginning to start to come down after many years of rises. And I think the Housing First has been part of that. I love some of the sort of ideas which come through with the awards. There was one we had a couple of years ago. A guy, he was a refugee in Algeria, Sahrawi, from Western Sahara. And he wanted to do something about his grandmother. His grandmother didn't have a proper home. And he worked out this idea of filling empty plastic bottles with sand and using them as so building blocks for building a house. And he designed a system of building houses where you could just use those things. plentiful sand in Algeria and plenty of waste plastic bottles. And he just got this system, worked it out, housed his grandmother, but then actually lots and lots of other houses were built in that kind of way, you know, effectively zero cost building materials and a technique which made the best of them. So I just kind of love seeing those ideas just sort of come out of nowhere and really make people's lives better.
That's David Ireland of World Habitat. One of the World Habitat Award winners is with us now, Yasmin Lahri.
Yes, I'm from Pakistan, and we're very honored when World Habitat awarded, you know, this 2018 award to our Stula, which is the earthen stove built by women themselves.
And to give our listeners a sense, this Chula, this stove made out of mud and lime plaster, looks kind of like a large raised platform, 6.5 feet by 8.5 feet. On top are three elevated stoves, spaces to store cooking utensils, and room for a family to sit and eat together. Since Yasmin invented the Chula back in 2014, it's been built tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of times.
کیونکہ پاکستان کی ایجاد ہے اور دنیا میں یہ اسی نام سے بہت مشہور ہو چکا ہے پاکستان کی دیہی علاقوں میں
Yasmin Lahri, you're all over YouTube with instructional videos, and others have put up their own videos as well. To call this a design success, I think would be an understatement.
And it's literally no cost, because they spend only about not even a couple of dollars. And basically, it's all to do with training as to how to build it, and they do it themselves. So I think what's important today is to understand that in countries like mine, which is Pakistan, and many other South Asian and Sub-Saharan African countries have huge populations below the poverty line. And whatever we do, they do fend for themselves, because the governments are not interested in getting down to helping them. And there are millions of them. You know, we need millions of shelters. And it's very important for us now to mobilize women, not to give them charity, but to help them to be able to do it themselves. And this is what we are trying to do with housing as well.
Well, it sounds great for people who don't have the funds to just go and buy a stove. But I think, if I understand this correctly, you were trying to do a couple of things at once. What were the problems with the ways that people were cooking before your design? What were the challenges that needed to be answered, defeated with your design?
Well, you know, women are often neglected. I don't think anywhere people are really concerned as to what kind of impossible situations they have to encounter. And a stove is the worst thing for many of, you know, women in my country and many others like us, where it's an open flame stove where smoke gets into their eyes, where they have all kinds of diseases with their lungs. Children get burnt and filth is all around them, and so you really can never cook healthy food. And so for me, what was important was to, first of all, to lift them from the floor. And because I work in disaster areas, so we just make these earthen platforms, which are very inexpensive. So the stove itself, which now has two saucepans that could be cooked, which is earthen, so it's really locally sourced material. It's very inexpensive. And it's a chimney which takes away the first kind of bit of the smoke that is there. Children are not burnt anymore. Everything is clean, so they are healthier. And I think most of all, which is kind of intangible characteristics, which is that they have now achieved dignity within their own societies. People now respect them more because they're not on the floor with the filth around them. And the other thing that's important is to understand that, you know, by making it themselves and beautifying it, and everyone is like a designer stove because they work in earth and beautiful patterns, each one is providing them an identity and pride that they have. So not only do we have to work with the poor in terms of giving them what I call the tangible kind of elements, but also the intangibles are equally important. And for women, this whole thing about dignity and being able to have self-respect, being able to or be empowered and have agency, these are the most important things which we do as architects, or must do as architects.
Well, you've been at this a while. The Chula was not your first initiative. You've been called the architect for the poorest of the poor. What are housing needs like in Pakistan? What are the demands, and what are the difficulties?
Well, I certainly like this title very much, and I think that's very important for us to know that architects can actually help the poor to rise above adversity, because architecture can be a great tool and design can be a great tool to be able to get to people where they can live have a much better life. And so for me, because I've been working in all kinds of disaster areas, and Pakistan is the fifth most vulnerable country today as, you know, climate change impact, we have to find ways to be able to get to people. And I think the biggest issue for me is, as David pointed out, they're always building. They have some sort of a place to live in. It's not that they are, you know, of course, they have no roof maybe, or but they have some sort of a space in which they can call their own. It may be only temporary. But the problem is that they're all not safe kind of building techniques. So every time there's a disaster, if there's a flood, they get washed away. If there's an earthquake, everything collapses. And the thing that I really want to do very much is to see how I can get to people to build at least one safe room, which will not be affected by these calamities. And also, I feel they have a right to four elements, if I may. One is a safe shelter. The other one is sanitation, a toilet, an eco toilet is what I promote. A chula, Pakistan chula stove, earthen one, nothing fancy. And then, of course, water. If we can just get these four things, then at least people can hope to have a certain quality of life, and they will be safe, and things will be hygienic. And once you've empowered them in this way, then they are ready to do anything else. So I've got something called the barefoot social architecture, where we talk about, you know, that we've got to do, really every aim should be for ecological and social justice both. We can't do just one and not the other today. So this is the attempt, and we're having some success with my video tutorials, and I'm pleased the way things are going, but there's millions that we have to reach out to, millions.
Well, those design goals that you lay out, it would be great if they were part of the remit of every piece of housing built for a poor person anywhere in the world. Sanitation, cooking, clean water to preserve health, preserve dignity. But you go a step further by emphasizing people being able to build it for themselves, by emphasizing the possibility for individuality, bringing creativity out of the people themselves. These things are not unimportant.
You see, what I feel is that for a long time, we have tried to give charity to people. We've treated everybody like a victim, thinking they need to be mollycoddled and given everything. And I call it the colonial Western charity model, which we've all received huge amounts of money, you know, and God knows where it's gone. It's not really helped people to be able to be equipped to be able to deal with all the problems themselves. So my feeling is, and my attempt has been to see how I can get to them directly. I don't want any intermediaries. I don't want government part of it, because government will never do it. They are not interested in those poor people. So if I can reach out to them, and especially women, because they are the worst sufferers. Nobody realizes what happens when a disaster strikes. They're the ones who become homeless. They're the ones who are displaced. They're the ones who've got to restart their lives and they don't know what to do. So somehow we have to get to them and do it through them. And so if we can do it and empower them, give them agency, plus also to teach them how they can actually build safe habitat, because that's the most important thing. And then also they're the ones who can be taught how to prepare for disasters, because the world is not thinking about disasters as seriously as they should. Everybody runs in when there's an emergency, puts in the money, God knows where it goes, and then everybody forgets about it. So disaster preparedness is the key if we want people to have a better life. And this is what our effort now is, mine is, to somehow get to them and get women in the forefront, and they will do it.
You've also got a YouTube channel. So you're spreading the word. You're not just keeping it to yourself and bottling up that knowledge. Was this something that came easily to you, becoming kind of an evangelist for low-cost housing for the poor?
Well, you know, as far as it wasn't, I don't think it was that kind of spirit, just that COVID happened, COVID-19. And I did not know how to get to people. I had no idea how, because everything was, there was lockdown, nobody could move, people were confined to their places. And that was the time when my team and I thought we should do something where we can really be able to reach out to everybody. And so all these tutorials we started to do, and this is to do, how do you make very simple things like lime and mud brick? How do you apply render to lime and mud brick, which has got lime in it? I don't use any cement or any steel, so it's all zero carbon as much as we can. And I only use bamboo. So they're the only three materials that I use now. And those are the ones that give us really the most sustainable way of building, because everything is locally sourced. And the, especially the new, not the new, but something I devised for an earthquake in the mountainous area, which is prefab bamboo panels. And those are becoming really, they are very flexible. They are modular. They can be used in many different ways. And you can control the quality and they can be transported anywhere. So those are becoming very popular because you can finish them off in whichever way you like. You can have thatch on it. You can have stones in it. You can, so because the basic structure is safe. It is just the panels that are structural. And the roof itself is also, it all collapses like an umbrella. Or if it's a dome, then we make these curved pieces. Actually, we've done these World Habitat Women's Centers that David had kindly, you know, sort of helped us with. And this is what we are doing in those. And people are building themselves. So I think the best way, if you want to get to the poor, if you are really serious, disaster preparedness, teaching them how they can put the plantation on, natural ways of doing things, because I just believe that it's tradition and heritage that teaches us how to go forward. We mustn't forget what we've had before. And that's what I'm taking forward. And I'm just very happy that people are listening to me.
Well, you know, there was a reason that the traditional was traditional in the first place. One of the most perplexing things about homes for the poorest people in the developing world, they're objects born of necessity, okay, so they're made of cheap available materials, but they're often wildly inappropriate to the climate conditions. They're like ovens in the summer and they're like freezers in the winter. And sometimes when local authorities build houses, the emphasis is on speed and cost rather than local materials and local expertise. In effect, they lock the family out of it by saying, here's your house. They'll build 500 of them or 1,000 of them and then say, here, just move in. What is the value of a family building their own house beyond just economic necessity?
You know, you're so right in the way you describe this, because it's all wrong the way we impose everything on people. We have an idea and we feel this is the right thing for them, and that's not true. If you work with people, with communities, you understand them, you guide them the process. And you are the ones, I mean, technical people are the ones who tell them how they can do it better and safer. But locally sourced materials and sustainable materials are the only way that we should now work with. Because we know that something like 38 to 40% of carbon emissions are because of the way we build today, which is cement and concrete and all the rest of it. Now, the problem of urban areas is slightly different. In the rural areas, I find a lime and I find earth and bamboo quite easily. In the urban areas, I will find bamboo, but I also find lots of other materials. And I feel that there's something called urban mining. You know, when you're working with the poor, you've got to make use of any resources that you find and see how you can use them intelligently and innovatively. And there's so much there that we can do. For instance, if there's a galvanized iron sheet, which is terrible to build with and the heat just pours in, but you can always line it with my lime mud plaster and you can make it livable. But you have to make them safe as well, because that's the biggest issue everywhere. A little bit of tremor, a little bit of rain, and everything gets destroyed. So we have to teach people how to build safer and better, and they will be okay, whatever money they spend on it.
If you're curious, if your interest has been piqued, I urge you to visit the Yasmin Lari Zero Carbon channel on YouTube to watch this work being done, maybe learn a little something yourself. David Ireland, so what's the killer app? Is it to adapt Yasmin Lari's designs to other places in the world? Or if you want to do this kind of work in Rio or Montevideo or Jakarta, find the Indonesian Yasmin Lari or the Brazilian Yasmin Lari.
Well, you'd be hard pushed to find another Yasmin Lari, but I think there is always somebody who does the role that Yasmin plays. There has got to be somebody, an inspirational person who's driving these things, because what you're doing is you're pushing against a system. You know, the housing system in most countries in the world is a commercially driven one, which is aimed at creating profits for people and not necessarily creating the best housing for the poorest people. So to push against that system, you've got to have somebody pretty tenacious and somebody who's prepared to challenge the status quo. So yeah, you do. You've got to have somebody like that. But also you've got to understand the context of the community and the context of the area. So, you know, having somebody from another country drop in and expect to replicate their system is not going to work. But actually, inspiration from people like Yasmin and many of the others who we've seen through the awards, and seeing, you know, being able to pick out bits which would work in a different context, I think has got real value. But you need the people on the ground who really understand the community to make it work properly.
You know, I agree with David. It's got to be, the context has to be right, and people should know the context before they do anything there. But I think there are certain principles that could be followed, which is to use really low carbon materials. So whatever you do, you're lowering the carbon footprint. The other thing is, I think the social justice part is very, very important. And again, involvement of women is very important. But of course, every country has to find its own solutions. Having said that, my little bamboo structure in Bangladesh, when they did it, it looked like a Bangladeshi structure. When you put it in Highgrove, it's looking like a pavilion, perhaps fit for that. So with bamboo, you can do many things. And I wish everybody grew bamboo, because it's really the most adaptable, wonderful material to use. And it's got a long life. So there's no reason for us not to opt for these other materials, and certainly give up concrete and steel.
Urbanity, the flock to cities, is one of the things that's driving this problem. If you look at a list of the world's largest cities 100 years ago, they were all industrializing, places where people were getting richer very fast. If you look at a list of the largest cities in the world today, it includes a lot of places that are getting big because people are abandoning the countryside, flocking to cities as a means of survival. And it seems to me that that's almost a recipe for inadequate housing, because the places those people end up living can be terrible places.
Yeah, you know, this is where jobs are, this is where facilities are, this is where the communities that they belong to often are. So it's a very rational thing to move to a city. And actually, a city done well is a great place to live. It's a very dense place where there's lots of jobs, there's lots of opportunities for people to sell their goods and to make money, and there's all the things that you need are there. So I think the challenge is to do cities well. And there are great cities. There are cities where very dense, where lots and lots of people are living, and lots of people are living good lives and living really well. Where it doesn't work is where you've got lots of people moving to a city where there's no room for them and where there is no provision for them. And they do the only thing that they can, which is to live informally, to live in spaces which people haven't given them permission to build the structures with the things that they can afford and the things that are to hand. And they then end up living in a very insecure way and in a very vulnerable way.
I was once in an informal settlement on the edges of Mexico City. And there was no community water. There was no community sewerage. And people said, well, you know, we asked the city if they would extend the services out here, but they said, we don't exist as a place. I wonder if design, if our definition of design isn't too narrow, whether there has to be kind of a legal architecture as much as a way to actually physically build spaces for people to live in.
Yeah, I think so. We're doing a fantastic piece of work with a group in Rio de Janeiro, and it's a favela, which has got very similar characteristics to what you're describing around Mexico City. And again, the people are there without the piece of paper which says that they own the land. They are insecure and in an informal settlement. But what's happening there, and the piece of work that we're doing with a great organization called CATCOMS, is where we're using the system of a community land trust, a mechanism which helps the community as a whole get control of the land, and the land can be transferred not to just each individual, but transferred to the community as a whole, which then gives the stability for people to be able to know that they can stay there and gives them the security. And what's great is that community, once that's worked, once the community land trust has got control of the land, actually they've got an asset which they can borrow against, and then you can start getting the facilities put in, the water supply, the electricity, all of the things that you need, because you've got an asset which you can borrow against. So I think there's a sort of great potential for formalizing the informal, but doing it in a way which actually works for the community, so that they've got sort of long-term security there and they've actually got the means to improve their community and their livelihoods.
Well, let's say you're selling food on the street or doing daily hire work on construction sites. How do you join a community land trust? Do you just present yourself at an office and say, here I am?
Well, you need the whole community to get together and decide that's what they want to do. So there was a great example in Puerto Rico, in a community there which was on the outskirts of San Juan, originally an area which this community sort of drained the mud and built their own houses on. And before long, San Juan had sort of grown and grown around them, and what had been the outside of the city became the center of the city, and it became prime real estate, and people were coming in and wanting to buy the land off people, and that community became a vulnerable place. And what they did is lots of people got together, seven different communities got together and said, look, we're all facing the same challenges here, and we can either just wait and be bitten off bit by bit by all these developers and our community will go, or we can get together and do something about it. And they got together and they got some legal representation, and they fought a fantastic campaign which took many years, and they got it, and they got the land transferred to a big community land trust which now has secured that land. The developers can't pick off bits of a community land trust. It's a big entity with big assets, and it's meant that you can now invest in that community and you can start improving the lives for those people, because they know they're going to be there. They're not going to be displaced, or they're not going to be pushed out, or they're not going to be bought off by somebody.
Well, a moment ago, we were talking about a house that costs $250 to build. But in the OECD member countries, in the richest countries in the world, $250 just doesn't get you very far. And it is just a tiny, tiny fraction of what it would cost to get a house built in Finland, in the United States, in Canada. David Ireland, are the responses to, are some of the fixes for homelessness in the world's wealthiest countries a totally different set of problems? Are they a totally different set of challenges? Or are there certain consistent principles that work whether you're in Bangladesh or in Ottawa?
So I think there's of course a lot of differences, and that you're operating in a system where everything costs so much more money and people have different needs. But I think one of the things I take from a lot of this is that there's ways in which you can challenge the system and make something more affordable and give communities powers to do more things than they could do otherwise. And one of those, I think, is the community land trust. So one of the problems why so many people are in housing poverty in the West is because of the price of land. Price of land has gone through the roof. And so, you know, people who could have afforded to buy a house or build their own house a few years ago can't do so these days. But one way of doing that is a community land trust, which separates out the value of the land from the price of the house. And then the community holds the value in the land, and people then only have to pay the cost of building the house. So I think, you know, similar to what I was talking about earlier in Rio de Janeiro, you can use those systems. And it's a growing movement, certainly in Europe and in other parts of the Western world, which I think actually is a real answer to what do people do when they can't afford the market, but actually the social housing system can't meet their needs either. You know, in places like London and Los Angeles, millions and millions goes into helping homeless people. And yet there's still, you know, you can go to Skid Row, where you can go to other places where there are thousands of people still on the street. So the system kind of doesn't work. It's not just the lack of resources, it's that those resources haven't been used most efficiently. So I think making things like community land trust can help. I think it can, you know, the housing first principle, finding ways in which you're spending that money in a way which is proven to be effective, can be a way in which you can really start to make some inroads and really start to help lots of people and allow them live the lives that they can potentially do, rather than relying on a system which isn't working at the moment.
David Ireland is chief executive of World Habitat. That's a UK-based international housing charity. Thanks for joining us on World Affairs.
Thank you, Ray. A pleasure of talking to you too.
And Yasmeen Lahri is celebrated as Pakistan's first female architect, founder and CEO of the Heritage Foundation of Pakistan. A great pleasure to talk to you, Yasmeen Lahri.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
That was David Ireland, CEO of World Habitat, based in London, and Yasmeen Lahri, architect to the poorest of the poor, based in Karachi, Pakistan. You can see her affordable housing tutorials at Yasmeen Lahri's Zero Carbon channel on YouTube. You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. If you missed any part of this episode or want to catch up on other international stories, download our podcast. Just search for World Affairs on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. At the top of the program, we highlighted creative housing solutions from people working directly with communities on the ground. But often these ideas get stuck in the neighborhoods where they're developed. How might local solutions be shared and refashioned across borders? Our next guest has some ideas. Lydia Stazen heads the Ruff Institute of Global Homelessness, a Chicago-based hub for housing research and action. The organization connects local actors, from Brussels, Belgium to Tshwane, South Africa, to an international network of strategic partners, all pushing to end street homelessness on every continent. Lydia Stazen joins me now. Welcome to World Affairs.
Thank you for having me.
We tend to talk about housing in hyperlocal terms. Does part of the problem, part of the challenge of convening a kind of worldwide conversation on housing come from that fact that we tend to think of it as very particular to a neighborhood, a town, a city?
Yeah, I think you've really hit on the crux of it there with that question. We all think about homelessness as something that's happening in our backyard, but the truth is it's happening in every single corner of the world, and there's so much that we can learn from each other globally on this issue. I think things like the pandemic, things like the crisis in Ukraine, again, really underscore we are a global community, and we rise and fall together. And so the more we can share learning, innovative practices on how to better address homelessness in ways that actually solve the problem and don't just manage it or move it around, the better off we all are. And so that's the space where IGH gets to sit and facilitate those international conversations on best practice and emerging ideas and solutions.
Your institute started something called the Vanguard Cities Project. What is it? What's a Vanguard City?
Yeah, our Vanguard Cities program started in 2017, and it really is founded on that idea that we have so much to learn from each other globally on the issue of homelessness, that it is a problem that exists in every corner of the world. And if we can all learn together what's working and where it's working and why it's working, we can do this work together better, smarter, and faster. We have right now 13 international cities that represent six continents that have come together as our first cohort of cities. They've all set a particular goal on addressing homelessness, and the IGH team partners with them. So what's the work plan towards those goals? What kind of resources, expertise, connections, mentoring from elsewhere in our global network do you need to make progress towards that goal? We've just ended our first cohort in a way, not really ended, but we've done an evaluation of that program. We're expanding the program. We're making some changes to it, and we're going to be bringing on some new communities into that cohort. So it's a pretty exciting time. So some of the things that we've learned out of that are, again, there are many similarities across really divergent contexts of what the drivers of homelessness are. It's poverty and lack of economic opportunity. It's lack of affordable housing or access to housing. It's interpersonal violence, mental health issues, physical health issues, it's substance use issues. All of these things are present in almost every community where IGH works. So I think I can name all 13 for you. It's Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, Chicago, Illinois, where IGH is headquartered, Little Rock, Arkansas in the United States. Moving down, we have Montevideo in Uruguay and Santiago in Chile. And then moving across, we've got Tshwane, South Africa, Bengaluru, India, Sydney, Australia, as well as Adelaide, Australia. And then moving up, we've got Brussels, Belgium, Rijeka, Croatia, Greater Manchester in the United Kingdom, and Glasgow in Scotland. I think that's all of them.
Still, even with that local focus, there must be some differences involved, not only in the nature of the problem, but in the solutions. If you're living in an informal settlement in Mexico City, or a farming community in Tanzania, or an alley or a lane in Jakarta, in a house that a family built for itself but isn't very good.
Yeah, that's right. There are definitely differences. So there's not a one-size-fits-all approach. There are some core principles that can be applied across contexts, but local communities and local governments need to adapt and make sure that those solutions are still working in Jakarta, in San Francisco, that sort of thing. And it does become the most complex when it has to do with the construction of housing and different local laws and regulations, and those types of things become incredibly complex.
And let's first talk about what doesn't work. What has IGH learned over time? Maybe trying it out and finding that in practice, it's not all it's cracked up to be. Are there some principles about the kind of approaches that simply don't get you where you need to be?
Yeah, definitely. So IGH works in partnership with local communities on six different continents. So we're able to look at the issue globally and in a really unique way. So some of the things we've learned over time that do not work are, first, energy that goes towards like the criminalization of homelessness. So saying homelessness is a crime here, you cannot put your tents here, you cannot live here. It just focuses the energy in the wrong kind of place, where really the focus needs to be on housing and services for people who are experiencing or at risk of homelessness. So all that legislation, all that criminalization is a waste of time and energy, and it does not solve the problem. So that's one thing that we learned. Another thing that we have learned does not work is this idea that someone needs to be ready for housing. So think about somebody is going to stay in temporary accommodation until they've got their mental health issue under control, or they've got a substance use issue under control. It actually works better to put them in housing, wrap them with services, and then they have the bandwidth, they have the security to tackle some of these other personal issues that they might be experiencing. So that model is sometimes called housing first, rather than the older sort of housing ready programs that have been proven not to work. Other things that don't work are extremely bureaucratic and complicated systems that we're expecting people who are dealing with the trauma of being homeless to navigate and to self-advocate for through many different social service agencies, that sort of thing. So the more that you can streamline a system, streamline what's happening across a city or a community, being very person-centered and applying kind of user experience and a person-centered design principles to how you set up a homelessness system within a city, those are all things that are going to speed up progress for individuals and for communities.
Some very different recent histories in this, in the case of those cities. A place like Schwane had a highly developed legal segregation system until just a blink of an eye ago. Chicago has some of the most expensive and some of the most blasted empty blocks in America. In Glasgow, you've got some promising developments, but also a lot of post-industrial decline, some really tough neighborhoods in Glasgow.
So Glasgow is also, I think, at least my most recent information is that they're the number one opioid death kind of capital for the UK. And so again, some really challenging issues around substance use and how to manage that. But they've also done a really, really brilliant job of decreasing their street homelessness. So that first category is they've got between 5 and 10 people who are living on the streets right now. And they were able to use the pandemic to get down to those numbers and to keep those numbers low. And they've done it through assertive street outreach, regularly being out there on the street and talking to people living there and really knowing them and understanding what they needed in order to come off of the street. And they've been providing really excellent services to people, finding them. They benefit from having a pretty significant amount of public and social housing there. So they have the units available. But again, that wasn't enough to do it. And so it's always these kind of mix of factors and how they interplay with each other that have allowed Glasgow to get over that hump. They've essentially eliminated their street homeless. They've closed down their congregate shelters and they don't plan to open those again. And so now they can really focus on, okay, how do we quickly move people who are falling into homelessness? How do we quickly move them into accommodation with services? And now they're able to start thinking about prevention efforts. So it's a really good example of how once you've tackled one part of the problem, you can expand and look at other issues as well. Another community that has done a really, really excellent job is Santiago in Chile, and they went hyper local. They focused on particular neighborhoods in Chile, and they implemented, again, I would call it assertive street outreach. So teams regularly going out onto the streets, getting to know the people experiencing homelessness and understanding what they would need to come in off of the streets. They have expanded and contracted their shelter system based on COVID, based on the weather. They have really cold winters down there, which are our summers, and they have seen some pretty significant reductions in their street homelessness as a result of those interventions. They also, it was a really interesting experience that they had during COVID, because prior to COVID, the police were viewed as very aggressive towards people who were homeless. But during the pandemic, they were able to build better relationships with the police officers. And then those police officers actually became the ones to take personal protective equipment out onto the street and deliver packages of support for people living on the street. And so now they've got a very different relationship. So again, necessity being the mother of invention, they've really seen a change there in how they're now able to partner with the police, whereas before it was a much more tense relationship.
Brussels and Chicago are in two of the richest societies on the planet. At the end of apartheid, I interviewed Joe Slovo, who was the first post-apartheid minister of housing. Sat in his backyard in Yeovil in Johannesburg, and he talked about there being not just a current housing shortage that needed to be met, but decades of accumulating housing shortage, demand that really, given the finances of the South African government, it would be impossible to meet. I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about the contrast and the challenges between a rich society that has choices to make and one that doesn't have as much finances but still has a daunting homelessness problem. Is there just less room for maneuver in a place like South Africa?
Yeah. One way that we think about it at IGH is, what is the resource environment? How are resources allocated right now to housing and services? Are there cost savings in other areas if we can move some of that resourcing over here? But we also like to challenge communities by saying, what if you never got one more unit of housing? What if you never got one more dollar for homeless services? There are still efficiencies. There are still ways of reworking the system that can be more effective. So we do both things. Obviously, we're always looking at the resource base and how things can be shifted or reallocated, but also how can sort of the services sector make changes on their end to be more effective at using the resources that they do have, because there's always things that can be tweaked and improved.
Lydia, if you could give us an example of an approach that worked in a city like Tshwane, which doesn't have a lot of resources.
Yeah, so our colleagues there really worked for years. It took them years, but they got a city council policy on homelessness passed at the city council level. And what that policy did was encourage collaboration between the services that already existed on homelessness. So the services that existed were operating in silos, and this really encouraged them, facilitated them, kind of working in partnership together. And so that's an example of how, again, if you're not getting another dollar on homelessness, if you're not getting another unit of housing, how can collaboration happen? How can different resources be pooled together to have a better impact on homelessness? And they've also just established a unit on street homelessness within their university to kind of build up that knowledge and that understanding within an academic setting that can go out and then have impact on the problem on the streets.
You've said the global dialogue on homelessness is dominated by English-speaking countries. I guess on one level that makes sense, since so many of the least affordable and most private property tradition-driven places in the world are in the English-speaking world, Canada, Australia, the United States, so on. Is it necessarily a problem to have the world dialogue on homelessness really sound a lot like English?
So the problem is we're missing out on really amazing programs, innovations, practices that are happening in other countries that aren't necessarily publishing their research or that information in English. So I always think we have an incredible network of researchers and scholars in Central and South America who are doing really brilliant work on homelessness. We're missing out on their knowledge and their expertise by not having that translation happening on all sides of things. So it's not that it's necessarily a problem, but there is so much learning and so much rich expertise and knowledge that the whole world is going to benefit from if we can bring all of those voices into the conversation.
At the end, is homelessness a policy choice? Is it not something that's imposed on a society, but something that a society chooses to tolerate?
I think the short answer is yes. It's very complicated when you think about the resource base as well. So I think for places like the United States, it's absolutely a choice. There can be better investment into public and social housing. There can be different policy choices made at a variety of levels, right? So not just federal, but state, local, et cetera, that have the potential to certainly street homelessness, shelter homelessness, that sort of thing. So I would say for the United States, yes, we are, our policies are choosing homelessness.
You're encouraging the sharing of data and expertise. You're looking for transferable models. You're encouraging promising methods to resolve this problem. What would you like to do that you can't do yet? What's next?
Yeah, and what we would like to do that we haven't really been able to grasp yet is two fronts. One is, I think, the continued work on the narrative that needs to happen, both with sort of policymakers and people who hold the power, but also with our neighbors, like we touched on before, that maybe don't want affordable housing developments in their neighborhood or don't want people experiencing homelessness moving into their neighborhood. So continuing to change that conversation and help people understand the drivers and the solutions, and that all of our societies will be better if we don't have homelessness at all. So that kind of component, that's will building. That's really tough, difficult work. And then I think the other component is always continuing to look at what is the evidence showing us and how can we continue to adapt based on what we're learning? Because maybe something is working exactly right on May 27th, 2022. That doesn't mean it's going to be working exactly that same way in 2 years. So that kind of continuous learning loop and a humility as those of us working in the sector to know that we may never have it all entirely figured out, but we need to be pushing forward on this kind of continuum, knowing that it can be better.
Been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or by making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. Additional support for this episode was provided by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is working alongside others to build a culture of health for everyone in America. And we want to hear from you. What did you think about today's episode? Are there other international stories you'd like us to cover? Please send an email or a voice memo to feedback@worldaffairs.org. Today's episode was produced by Polly Stryker and Andrew Stelzer. It was edited by Joanne Jennings, with mixing and mastering by Matteo Schimpf. Research and fact-checking was provided by our associate producer Ryan Housel and Elise Manoukian. Additional production and engineering provided by Rob Spate. Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Philip Yun is CEO of World Affairs. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.